This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm your host, Andrew Brill, and this is your weekly market recap. This week, James Conner spoke with the president and CEO of Rule Investment Media, Rick Rule. He remains impressed with the U.S. economy despite some of the indicators, and he remains bullish with respect to physical gold.
What are your views on the U.S. economy, and do you have any concerns, either domestically or globally?
I continue to be impressed by the strength of the U.S. economy. As we said in our last discussion, I would have expected a doubling in the nominal interest rate, which is what we saw, to have a much more deleterious impact on the U.S. economy, given how much private credit there is in the system. It would appear, too, that confidence remains strong, despite the ballooning interest payments that are taking place at the federal, state, and local level. All I can say, paradoxically, is so far, so good. The Canadian economy appears less strong, which makes some sense. It's a smaller economy, a smaller domestic market. But the strength of the U.S. economy impresses me. I suspect that given this year is an election year, that we will see the Fed under increasing pressure to lower interest rates. As a human being and a market participant, I hope they don't. But I suspect that the political pressure to lower interest rates, even despite a very strong economy, will be such that the Fed will feel the need to lower interest rates, which I think will have a very positive impact, if not on the economy and not on the country, on the stocks that you and I follow. I want to take a little issue with something you said too, James, which is to say a strong CPI number. I would argue that the CPI is not a relevant gauge of inflation if your definition of inflation involves the deterioration of the purchasing power of your savings relative to cost increases. The CPI, among other things, doesn't include the largest household expense that you and I face, which is tax. And a cost of living index that doesn't include tax is an erroneous index. So I would suggest to you that while the CPI number doesn't look unattractive, it's an irrelevant statistic because it doesn't measure the cost of living. And the confidence that I talked about before, I think will be challenged over time when Americans and Canadians understand just how much less far their paycheck goes than it went 5 years ago. But let's enjoy the economy that we have while we can.
So let's talk about inflation. And you just made mention earlier about the CPI number. I agree with you totally, by the way. Every time I see that CPI number, I just multiply it by two or three to get the real number. But why don't we have a discussion on inflation now and what's happening?
I would urge your listeners to do a thought exercise and look at their budget and determine for themselves what is happening in terms of the maintenance of the purchasing power of their own savings and their own salaries relative to the package of goods and services that they consume. I've tried to do this for 5 years running now, and I'm not suggesting that this is by any means an accurate picture. But I would suggest that in terms of the basket of goods and services that I consume, that the purchasing power of my savings is declining by about 7% compounded. When I say basket of goods and services, that includes tax. I'm not sure that I consider tax to be either a good or a service. But the truth is that taxes consume more than 40% of my household budget, despite my best efforts to the contrary. And any measure of the cost of living, which didn't include tax for Americans and Canadians, is an erroneous sense of the cost of living. But it goes beyond that. The big thinkers would have you look at core CPI, which doesn't include food or fuel. The problem with that is I like to eat. So that sort of performance mechanism is of very little value too. And beyond that, it's hedonistically adjusted, which is to say the people who compile the index assign arbitrarily values associated with the allegedly improving quality of the products that you buy. My suspicion, as I say, is that despite the fact that the CPI, or the CPI, as the WAGs describe it, is running at about 2.6% compounded, my own arithmetic, the price of gasoline that I put in my vehicle, the price of food I eat, the price of airline tickets, and of course, the price of direct and indirect taxation, suggests to me that the basket of goods and services that I consume is increasing at about 7% compounded. That becomes problematic over time. I emphasize over time. Many of your listeners who aren't as old as I won't have a memory of the late 60s and the early 70s, a period which I would suggest is eerily similar to the period that we face today. The writing was on the wall with regards to U.S. inflation beginning in 1967. The combination of the war on poverty, which we lost, and the war in Vietnam, which we lost, meant that it was very obvious that government debt and government promises were at an unsustainable level. Despite that, it took from 1967 to 1972 or 1973, 5 or 6 years, for the average American to have experienced enough deterioration in their purchasing power that inflation came to be a concern. I think that's what's going to happen today. I think what's going to happen is in one of the out years, 2025, 2026, I don't know. But in one of the out years, the incredible deterioration in purchasing power that we have seen as citizens between 2021 and today is going to become very, very, very squarely in focus.
And so I guess I want to ask you how we can protect ourselves against inflation and against the erosion of our purchasing power. One of the ways is to do that is through gold, physical gold. What are your views on gold in here? It's had a nice move. I think it's up over 10% on the year.
You know, gold's done its job. People have asked me for years, when's gold going to move? And I say, 2000. Price of gold in 2000 was $253, $254 an ounce. And it moved up to sort of $1,900 an ounce. So that's what, 8.6, 8.7% compounded for 22 years. If you're asking for a commodity that as a savings instrument could shield you against inflation, if you look at when gold was going to move at the beginning of the century, it did move. The move has accelerated and it has excited people. To me, the move that we've seen so far is a non-event, really. I think it's a flow of funds issue. I don't own gold because I think it might go to 2,400 or 2,200 or whatever the number is. I own it because I'm afraid of the possibility, not the probability, but the possibility that it goes to $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000. That's not very far-fetched. In the decade 2000 to 2010, admittedly, it took 10 years, the gold price went up sevenfold. It doesn't seem like too much to ask, given the deterioration in the purchasing power around fiat instruments, for the gold price to triple. I frankly hope it doesn't, but I sort of think it will. Let's examine, James, the recent strength in the gold price. This didn't happen because retail investors were concerned, expressing concerns about the deterioration of their purchasing power. It didn't happen for traditional reasons. It happened because the U.S. government weaponized the U.S. dollar. They confiscated $300 billion worth of Russian holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. That made other countries who don't necessarily favor policies that are attractive to the U.S. government concerned about their own holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. The second thing that the U.S. did is they weaponized the SWIFT banking system. The SWIFT banking system is supposed to be an international settlements mechanism using the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. It is not the property of the United States. But when the SWIFT banking system began to be weaponized to further the political interests of the United States government overseas, other central banks felt themselves left with no choice other than to look for a store of value and a medium of exchange that was outside of the control of the U.S. government. The easiest place to go was gold. Many people say, well, why don't they just trade with each other in their own currencies? There's an easy answer to that. As little as they trust us, they trust each other less. The U.S. dollar, laughingly, is the worst currency in the world, with the sole exception of every other currency. The Chinese don't want a trillion rubles. And what that means is that in order for Iran to trade with China, China to trade with Russia, Russia to trade with Brazil, they need a medium of exchange outside the U.S. dollar. And the strength that you have seen in gold has been almost entirely foreign central banks buying gold because they don't have any other alternatives. If you lay on top of that the realization on the part of investors that their own purchasing power is degraded by holding fiat currencies, I think you could see sharply higher gold prices. Here's another statistic to support that, James. According to J.P. Morgan Chase, the market share of precious metals and precious metals-related assets in the United States is about 0.5% of the total value of savings and investment assets in the United States. For reference, the United States has a 23% market share of world savings and investment assets. J.P. Morgan Chase suggests that the four-decade mean market share of precious metals-related securities is 2%. So if precious metals merely reverted to mean, demand for precious metals and precious metals-related assets would quadruple in the largest savings and investment market in the world. And that's precisely what I think is going to happen.
Anthony Pompliano joined Speak Up with Anthony Scaramucci. He explains how he thinks the Fed and their goal of tightening things in the economy has taken a back seat to politicians who just keep spending. He also talks about the Bitcoin halving event coming up and gives some advice on how to make some money.
I'm going to say the following word. I want you to react to the word. Okay, you ready?
Okay.
Inflation.
Horrible.
Okay. But let's go here. 22% of the dollar has been destroyed, okay, in the last 4 years. So if you're a laborer, let's say you're like my dad, may his soul rest in peace, you're working a crane, they pay you $1,000 in January 2020, you have $780 of purchasing power today.
Yeah.
Yes, horrible, destructive to a society, destructive to lower and middle income people. What are we going to do, Pomp? And what's going to happen?
Yeah, look, I don't think that there is anything that the Fed or others can do because structurally they have been put in the back seat. And the way I think about this is if the central bank alone was making decisions, although they are slow, although they make mistakes, if you kind of have one person in charge or one group in charge, they can kind of over a long period of time at least keep the train kind of on the tracks. And so what I mean by that is they definitely were too slow to increase interest rates in 2021 and 2022, but they eventually did do it. And, you know, year over year inflation started to come down. Now, part of the problem has been that the politicians, they didn't get the message. the politicians, they're still spending like drunken sailors. And so at the same time that the Fed is trying to create tighter, you know, financial conditions, drain liquidity from the market, you have politicians in the same country who are doing the opposite. So they're basically fighting with each other from a policy standpoint. Then when you zoom out from just the United States to the global world, you know, at least the Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, you know, many of the top central banks, they've all been on the same page since 2022, which is let's drain liquidity. Let's kind of create these tighter financial conditions. China, on the other hand, basically said, you know, we don't care what you guys are doing. Our economy, our stock market, we need to be pumping liquidity into the market. And so China has been actually acting against, on a global liquidity standpoint, these other major central banks. And so when you look at this, it's one single central bank actually has been taken out of the control position and kind of put in the back seat. So they still have some impact, but I think that's a huge problem. The second thing is there's a psychological scarring that occurs with consumers that I think is drastically under-discussed. And so what I mean by that is if inflation is high in 2021 into 2022, that doesn't go away. You don't just wake up one day and be like, oh, I don't worry about inflation anymore. And so a lot of what we're seeing in society, I call it, you know, we've become a society of gamblers. We have sports betting becoming highly popular, being integrated in all these different areas. The lottery is bigger than it's ever been before. You see zero-day options being the majority of options traded on Wall Street now, meme coins and crypto and all these things kind of taking place. And a huge piece of it is psychologically, some large portion of the population has just lost hope. How do you get ahead, right? How do you do anything? And so if you look at it from a rational position, if I buy a lottery ticket, it's 300 million to one odds. If I buy a meme coin, maybe it's, I don't know, 50-50 odds it goes up, right? Like, you know, it's much better. Sports betting is better than the lottery, et cetera. And so people are almost like trying to become more sophisticated by doing the gambling. They're just moving to like things with better odds.
Right.
But, you know, look, it's a story as old as time. Like, I don't think that you're going
to
be able to.
The destruction of the money is causing people to take more risk because they're trying to catch up with the money destruction, right?
Yeah, of course. But I also think that, you know, because we can identify it's happening doesn't mean that it's, you know, this time is different and all of a sudden like gambling is going to be some great investment strategy. Like it is still a horrible way to invest capital and try to compound capital over time. But you can understand why people are doing it while not agreeing that that is what they should be doing.
And people write into us and many people don't understand the halving. Some people are like, are they going to have my Bitcoin in my account? What does it mean for supply? You're a great explainer of things. Start from base layer of zero and tell us what the halving actually means and tell us what's going to happen. And when do you think it happens? Approximately April 18th, 19th, 20th, something like that?
Yeah. The last time I looked, April 20th is when it will occur. You know, obviously, the most entertaining outcome is the most likely. So the Bitcoin halving occurring on 420 is like, you know, made for the internet and memes. Right. When you think of the halving, let's talk about gold, right? Gold is dug up out of the ground, kind of 1-2% increase in the circulating supply of gold each year. You can imagine if all of a sudden half of the gold miners shut down and you now only had 50% of the previous supply coming into the market. If demand stayed the same, then obviously the price of gold would go up, right? With Bitcoin, that's basically what's occurring. Is right now there are 900 Bitcoin a day that come into the market that are net new to the circulating supply. After the halving, it will programmatically, you know, kind of executed in the software, go to 450. And so if you have demand stay just the same, doesn't even have to go up, just the same demand, but now you have 50% less incoming daily supply, the price should readjust higher to kind of accommodate everyone. And so, you know, it's a pretty basic idea. I think what people get tripped up on is they can imagine if 50% of the gold miners shut down their facilities or stopped, you know, kind of digging gold out of the ground. When you talk about the software is just going to do it, all of a sudden people say, well, how do I know that? Or, you know, why does the code execute that way? How can I confirm it? Beauty of Bitcoin is you can confirm it, but there are some technical skills or experience that are needed in order to be able to understand the intricacies.
Okay, so we have 900 coins being produced by the network now, and it's going to 450. how much demand do you think we have on a daily basis for Bitcoin?
I mean, just the ETFs alone, the inflows at one point were 12x, you know, that number. So you can kind of think about in Bitcoin terms, there's 900 Bitcoin a day that are coming into the market. There was at one point, you know, 10,000 to 12,000 Bitcoin that people actually were looking for in the ETFs. Now, some of that has kind of slowed down a little bit. But one of the beauties of the halving is not only the fact that the halving occurs, but everyone starts talking about it. So if you go and you watch, you know, CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox Business, Yahoo, whatever, they're all talking about it right now. And so the more that people talk about Bitcoin, the more people that become interested in it. And so demand likely will go up through the end of the year. It won't happen rapidly, but it will continue to increase. And so you have this like demand shock where more, you know, people are coming in wanting Bitcoin at the same time that you have a supply shock where it's getting cut in half. And so in the past, you know, these halvings, the last one occurred when Bitcoin was $8,000, Bitcoin went to $69,000. Right. When it occurred in the cycle before that, there's more than 20x increase in price. And so I don't think that we will see more than 8x, but I do think that we will see, you know, hundreds, kind of low hundreds of price appreciation, which, you know, obviously is good for people who are holding the asset.
Here at Wealthy, I'm going to try to help people make money, make them look smart, make smart decisions to secure their future. If a friend came to you today and said, what should I do in the market this week? Maybe it's the same thing every week, Pomp. I don't know. But what should I do in the market this week? What would that be?
Yeah, the way I always have thought about this is I have an asset allocation kind of framework in my head percentage-wise. And then I just think about I am saving in that asset allocation percentage. So I'll make numbers up, but let's just say that I said, okay, 25% public markets, 25% bonds, you know, 25% kind of Bitcoin and 25% venture capital. Then what I would do is every week, whatever money I was going to have left over, I would just put in those buckets and try to automate as much of it as possible. You know, you had a great line at Bitcoin Investor Day where you said the best thing to do with your Bitcoin is act dead. Well, I think that, you know, if you extend that out, one of the most specific things that you can do when it comes to investing is you can just automate that process so that every single week you're not thinking through what's the best thing, you know, I should do this week. It's just, hey, I've got a plan and go focus on making more money so that you can continue to get more money into your kind of investment account.
So it's a really good piece of advice. So what are some of the things you're allocating to then?
I am not very exposed to the public markets. I only have really one personal holding in the public markets, which is a company called DeFi Technologies in Canada. I think that they are drastically undervalued. You know, I'm a shareholder personally. We've sold a business to them. You know, very bullish on that business.
What's the symbol? It's publicly traded in Canada. What's the symbol?
Canada. I think it's DEFTF, if I remember correctly. Okay. And yeah, they're an altcoin ETF issuer. The company most recently, when they did an earnings report, was trading at, you know, kind of $140 million market cap approximately. And their guidance was that they're going to do, I think, $46 million in revenue, you know, in 2024. And so it's just, I think, something that's mispriced, but, you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe I'm wrong. When it comes to everything else, I do a lot of early stage investing. Those are usually early stage technology companies. They're in the private market. They stay illiquid for a very long period of time. They're very asymmetric. They're, you know, zeros, or we're going to get back hundreds of percent on the upside, but usually takes about 10 years to get those back. And then I continue to allocate to crypto. I have a Bitcoin position. The second biggest position that we have is Solana. And then, you know, we're looking at other things and we'll probably come up with other ideas of what we should be doing there. And then probably the biggest investing we do is in the companies. Like, we want to continue to reinvest in our own companies that can help us generate cash flow and enterprise value. And so, you know, we have a skill set and experience doing that. And that usually drives a pretty good return as well.
Nicholas Kolas of Data Trek Research joined Wealthion and gave us his expert opinion on where he thinks interest rates are headed and how many cuts we may get this year. He also talks about how we really should be measuring inflation.
Here we are now. We just entered Q2. And I want to get your views on where you think interest rates are going and what the Fed's going to do and if and will they cut this year.
Yeah, you're right. We came into the year thinking we're going to get a lot of cuts. 2 years reflected that. Fed fund futures reflected that. And thankfully, the equity market didn't really believe it because rates have gone up. And the expectation now is we might get three. I think Fed funds futures are still the modal expectations, roughly at three, you know, 35% odds, give or take. But there's a pretty even distribution that says two might be the answer. And now much less of a guess that four might be the answer. I think we've taken four safely off the table. The issue we face right now is pretty straightforward, and it's a mixed thing for equities. Because on the one hand, the economy seems to be doing still pretty well. It's not great, but we're getting 2% growth, more or less. We're getting reasonable job numbers even after revisions come through. We're getting pretty sticky wage growth, which means that consumers are getting paid a little bit more than inflation, but it's not coming down very quickly. There's still a labor shortage in this country in a lot of different sectors. And that's driving wages to be much stickier than they otherwise would be. You know, the reason inflation declines after a recession is because wage growth slows down to basically zero. We haven't had a recession, anything but really. So we've had wage growth continue to be pretty high. And so inflation has stayed high. And this is the central problem for the Fed. Powell talked about it last Friday, talked about it yesterday. We're not seeing that kind of slowdown in wage inflation that will allow overall price inflation to keep coming down. And so inflation is proving very sticky. My perspective is I think we get two rate cuts this year, not three. The Fed is usually wrong. Like we just saw the Fed's latest projections last month for rate cuts over this year. They still said three. But on average, most of those March projections they gave are wrong by at least one cut or one increase. And so I'm thinking they're wrong by one. And we get two, probably in July, and then not until December. The Fed does have to deliver on its promise or risk losing credibility yet again. And you pointed out that they've rightly lost credibility before and in the recent past. They really can't afford to make that mistake again. They can afford one or two rate cuts, but they have to go slow. So I see the pace of rate cuts as very slow this year. And I don't think two-year yields come down very quickly, and tens might actually go up over the near term. So pretty tough situation for bond traders, but I think still okay for stocks because we do have the backstop of decent wage growth, a decent economic picture, and enough to create some corporate earnings growth.
What's your take on inflation? I know you just said that there's an issue with wages, but from my perspective, just being the average guy on the street, when I go to the grocery stores or when I go to buy gas or whatever, I see prices just continuing to go up, and I think they're going up by a lot more than 3% annually.
Yes. I mean, there's always been a lot of debate about how accurately CPI or PCE or any of the other common measures of inflation really measure actual felt inflation. And I'd say most of the academic work on this topic reflects exactly the dynamic that you just described. People look at inflation as primarily the cost of food and energy, and everything else kind of falls to the wayside. And so people's impressions of inflation are always higher than the actual reported numbers. This goes back decades, literally. So it's an important problem because ultimately people anchor their inflation expectations on what they see and what they feel every day and every week when they go to the store or go to the gas pump. And that's the reason inflation does feel a lot higher. And we also have to remember that inflation compounds. So if we go up 10% in 1 year and 5% the next year and 3% the year after that, which is a rough approximation of what I think we all felt inflation's been like over the last couple of years, you still see higher prices and it just never gets better. And all you have to hope is that ultimately your wages catch up to the inflation that you're feeling. And unfortunately for a lot of households, it doesn't. And so there's that persistent feeling that inflation is going to be higher. And that's a real problem for the Fed. And I've written about this and it's an important issue because the Fed's credibility is ultimately tied to how successfully it deals with inflation in this part of the cycle. And right now they don't get a very good grade, as you very rightly point out. And all we can hope for is that ultimately things catch up. But the current situation is definitely tough and definitely we all feel it. I mean, you know, my analog in New York is I have a favorite diner that I go to for breakfast, you know, some mornings. And I had a cup of coffee and an egg sandwich. And that used to be $7. And now it's $13.54 every day. And so I'm fortunate to be able to pay it. But I do look at that bill every day and say, crap, that's just a lot more money than it used to be.
And so you mentioned gas and the price of gas, and this is another. So when we look at CPI, we're looking at shelter, we're looking at food, and we're looking at energy prices, right? Those are the three major components representing about 75% of CPI. And so oil, the price of oil is just ripped from $75 a barrel up to 85, give or take. And who knows, maybe it moves to 100 bucks. And of course, the Biden administration is trying to keep the oil prices down as we head into an election. And then you got the Saudis who want a higher oil price. Of course, they want to make more money. But are you concerned about this move that we've seen in the oil price and the impact that it might have on the economy and also CPI?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. I mean, oil prices have been one of the surprise moves of the year. Gold's been the other one. We can discuss gold as well. That's a fascinating story on top of that. You know, the geopolitical situation is not getting any better in the Middle East. We know that. And so gas prices, oil prices are going to keep climbing, I think. I wouldn't rule out $100 a barrel at all. I think it's a very logical kind of midsummer kind of price because, as we know, there's some seasonality to oil prices. The thing that I've focused on in looking at how oil prices affect the economy is that you basically need oil prices to go up 80% in a year to assure a recession. So if you go back to 1990 and the oil shock around the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, or if you go to even 2007, we had the commodity super spike and oil prices went to 140. Every time oil prices go up 80% or more in a year, we get a recession. So the good news is we have some leeway with oil prices before they actually definitely cause a recession in Western economies. We're pretty far away from that. I think we're up 20% year on year, 30% year on year. But if we get to 120, 130 a barrel, that's for sure going to create a recession. And I do worry about that. As far as energy's effect on inflation, you know, I just actually was doing this math a couple of days ago. There's actually not much of a linkage between oil prices and CPI, PCE, core headline, no matter how you want to cut it, in terms of when oil prices spike, does that affect inflation? And the reason is because when oil prices spike, you get a recession. And so you get this kind of countervailing effect. It's not a very welcomed effect, obviously. But if oil prices spike, you don't get a spike in inflation. You actually get a downdraft because the economy slows so quickly that prices have to come down. So we don't want that kind of recession. We don't want that kind of outcome. But oil prices don't generally create inflation in most parts of the cycle. What they do is they create a recession that brings inflation down. Again, not what we want, but that dynamic is somewhat offset one against the other.
And of course, we have to talk about Bitcoin. That's the SEC approved Bitcoin ETFs in January of this year. And as a result, we've seen hundreds of billions of dollars flown into these products. Once again, you're not concerned about this level of speculation?
I actually have covered Bitcoin for a long time. I was actually the first Wall Street analyst to put, you know, pen to paper and write for institutional clients about it back in 2012 and 2013. So I've followed the space a long time. And what I think we're seeing is, you know, what started as a science project basically is becoming an asset class. People believe in this space. And it's not like gold in that gold, you know, half of gold demand is jewelry and physical use demand, real demand, and half of gold is for investment, central banks, other things. Bitcoin only has the speculative investment part of the equation. So it's always going to be more volatile than gold. But there are a class of people, and that class is growing, that view digital assets, digital currencies as an aspiring asset class. And that's, I think, whether you think it's valid or not, it's just a fact. That's the way the market's heading. And so do I worry about Bitcoin being a sign of speculation? Not especially. Speculation to me, I worry when it has big moves and then begins to fall apart. And Bitcoin's done that several times, but it's still around. And so, you know, I think it's, for some people, they want to consider it an asset class, and that's fine. I personally think it's interesting. It's not yet an asset class by any means, but there's enough people who think that way. And the ETF approvals kind of show that. Even the SEC says that's an okay thing to try, that I'm not super worried about Bitcoin's move being indicative of some major market top or excessive investor enthusiasm across asset classes. It's kind of particular to those digital currencies.
Chris Casey of Windrock Wealth Management joined Wealthion and expressed real concern about rough times in 2024 due to some of the economic indicators he's seeing.
So let's talk about the current market a little bit. Your view on the economic situation or how things are playing out and not to, we'll get into your outlook, but what do you think of things right now? It seems like we have inflation somewhat under control. That last 1% is being really, really stubborn. The jobs report just came in way above expected. What's your take on the economy as we sit right now?
Well, let's see. We had an earthquake in New York City.
Yes, we did.
We have an eclipse here in a few hours. It's what more signs do we need that there could be trouble down the road? And if this was 1,000 years ago, you know, people would be running for the hills. But right now, investors seem to take a mentality of, I wouldn't call it necessarily irrational exuberance, but I would call it irrational complacency. No one's very concerned about the markets, financial markets. No one's very concerned about the economy. There's even headlines now that say all these people that predicted a recession, let's say 9-12 months ago, are now kind of throwing in the towel and saying we won't have one. Now, I have a different view. I do think we could be in some really rough times in 2024. I do think it's very likely we could have a recession. I think there's some very ominous signs pointing in that direction. And on top of that, we're going to have potentially some strife with the upcoming election. And then even towards the end of the year, I think eventually we're really going to be talking about a solvency crisis for the United States dollar.
So what are the signs you're seeing that kind of point you into that trouble you see in 2024?
Well, I think it's important to point out, first of all, that a lot of people, a lot of pundits, a lot of economists, a lot of government officials will talk about whether or not we have a recession. And for the most part, they're reading tea leaves, right? They're just looking for particular signs. I mean, Greenspan was famous for this. You may remember articles about him, like in the bathtub studying steel production output. And if you don't have a theory as to what causes a recession, you can't weave all these indicators together. It's not really going to be meaningful, either in magnitude or timing or probability. And, you know, I particularly subscribe to the Austrian school of the business cycle, which blames the Federal Reserve or any central bank for recessions. It explains all the phenomena that we see within a recession. And probably the best indicator of whether or not that's playing out, and the Federal Reserve admits this himself, is the inverted yield curve. Typically, when the yield curve inverts, so the short-term rates are higher than longer-term rates, you will see a recession anywhere from, say, 6 to 22 months after that. We're at month 15, so right kind of in the kill zone of where we would expect something. That doesn't mean it's going to happen right away, but it would argue that people should be more concerned than less concerned.
So let's talk about the interest rates. It's obviously the one topic a lot of people are talking about. It now seems that everything that I'm reading now is like, oh, maybe two cuts. You know, we began the year at 6 or 7, then we whittled that down to 3. Now we're down to 2. Where do you see interest rates going in 2024?
Well, I'm not sure, but I would argue that the only people that are less sure than me would be the Federal Reserve. I don't think they know. And I think they've proven time and time again that they're extremely reactionary, right? Whether they're predicting something, for instance, every year they're coming out with a range of what they think GDP will be or rates, they're always wrong, and not just wrong, but typically the accurate number is ultimately outside their very range, right? So, and look at how they've reacted with inflation over the last couple of years, right? It was transitory, you know, it wasn't them, you know, everything they do is reactionary. So I don't think they know. They're really trying to have their cake and eat it too, right? So I think what they're trying to do is they want the so-called curb inflation. That's definitely, but at the same time, they want a high stock market. And everyone talks about a dual mandate for the Federal Reserve, how they, but it's really a triple mandate. I don't even know why they call it a dual mandate, because they have to have reasonable interest rates, a lower price level, you know, low unemployment. But the fourth undocumented mandate would be that they want a high stock market. And some mistaken belief in that it's good for the economy, but they're constantly trying to push that and jawbone the market up. And I think that's what they're doing here. They're always dangling the idea of they're going to cut rates, but whether or not they do, I don't think they know.
They look at the CPI and they look at the numbers, you know, people spending money. They can't get that number down. I think it's around 2.8, 2.9. They want it at 2. If that starts to creep up, do you see a scenario where they could actually raise interest rates a quarter of a point or an eighth of a point just to try and inch that down a little bit more?
I do see that. By the way, the 2% target is very strange. There's absolutely no academic literature why it should be 2%. In fact, I think it was Yellen at the time that said it's 2% because they want a margin before you get to zero. And there's nothing wrong with zero. I don't know why they're so scared of it. So I could see that scenario happening, but probably a bigger concern is I can see rates increasing simply because the amount of debt that's being rolled over by the federal government, right? It's almost a third of the federal debt that's being rolled over this year. And that spells very serious issues for the fiscal situation for the U.S. government. And it should raise rates across the board in general.
Is it for the country, Chris, is it as simple as cutting back spending and cutting things that, you know, raising taxes a little bit just to try and bring a little bit more money in? Is that how we get this under control?
Well, I personally think that the problem is so big that it almost doesn't matter what you do. It's a major problem. So it would take the most draconian, it's just politically not feasible to do what needs to be done. Number one is just to get a handle on entitlement spending, right? That'll never happen in any political climate, no matter who's in control of Congress, no matter who's in the White House. So I'm pretty pessimistic on the long-term fiscal chances of the U.S. government. But it's a pretty easy formula. It's just that it's something you could pass.
The Fed says they don't really, whatever they're going to do with interest rates, they don't want to do it close to the election. How quickly do you think, if people are saying June, July, look, July is not far from it's only 4 months from the election. So if they don't really want to touch interest rates before the election, we're getting really close to that danger zone, aren't we?
We are. And July is also 1 or 2 months before the conventions, which is a big deal, right? Like I said before, I don't know if they're going to do anything. I suspect they don't know. I suspect nothing's going to happen this year. They're just trying to talk the markets up. That's how I think it may play out.
How is this election affecting our financial markets? There's some that I know some think one president is better for the markets, the other president is worse for the markets. How do you see it playing out at this particular point in time?
Well, it's hard to say because I actually suspect it's not so much a matter of who wins, but who runs. I'm not convinced that President Biden will actually be the nominee. I strongly suspect he would be replaced at the convention. I could see that happening. It's the most natural time to do it. And on Trump, I don't know. First of all, I have to pay him a compliment. His stamina for his age is amazing. I mean, to run for president, to oversee a business empire, and to deal with all these litigious matters at the same time is absolutely amazing. Anyone that's ever been involved in litigation knows it's extremely stressful and time consuming. So I don't know how he does it, first of all. But they are determined not to have him run. So we have to see how that plays out as well.
Thank you for watching Wealthion's weekly market recap. Check out the links to the full interviews in the description. And remember, if you need help being financially resilient, head to Wealthion.com, sign up for a free, no obligation consultation with one of our vetted registered investment advisors. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and hit the notification button to hear about upcoming videos. Thanks again for watching. We'll see you next time. Until then, stay informed, be empowered, and may your investments flourish.
Thank you.